From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Love and Money, we talk with sociologist Marcia Millman about how husbands and wives and parents and children deal with money and why they have such a hard time talking about it. And as plans are made for talks between Protestant and Catholic leaders in Northern Ireland, we talk with Padraig O'Malley. In his book, Biting at the Grave, The Irish Hunger Strikes and the Politics of Despair, he challenges the myths and the conventional wisdom behind the politics of Northern Ireland. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. There have been more demonstrations in Addis Ababa against the occupying forces of the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front. The interim government has been trying to return the city to normal. But as the BBC's Colin Blaine reports, there is still considerable anger in the capital over the prospect that the northern province of Eritrea might break away.
In the last 2 years of civil war, before President Mengistu finally fled the country, he repeatedly urged Ethiopians to march to the front to defend the unity of the nation. It was an appeal which helped to sustain an unpopular leader in power. It tapped the strong emotional nationalism of central Ethiopians, in particular the Amhara. And now that Colonel Mengistu has gone, many of them are angry that after so much fighting for unity, the country may be breaking up. In one demonstration, a crowd of several hundred confronted EPRDF troops, waving Ethiopian flags and banners saying, One Ethiopia.
One Ethiopia! One Ethiopia!
One Ethiopia!
Stones were thrown at the troops, who fired in the air to disperse the crowd. They fled as a tank rolled towards them.
The BBC's Colin Blaine reporting from Addis Ababa. European community leaders have agreed to give Yugoslavia $1 billion and say they're prepared to give the country even more money to keep it from breaking up. The billion is intended to help Yugoslavia manage its $17 billion foreign debt. The Republic of Croatia says it will secede on June 30th from the country if no action is taken to resolve the current crisis by June 15th. A divided Supreme Court ruled today that in a celebrated criminal case, a trial judge does not have to question potential jurors individually about the contents of news reports that they have read or heard. The case involved David Moomin, a convicted murderer who killed a second person while out of prison on a work release program. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The case provoked considerable pretrial publicity, including stories about Moomin's confession. But at Moomin's trial, the judge screened potential jurors in groups of four and refused to question them specifically about what they'd read or heard. Of the 12 jurors eventually chosen, 8 said they'd read about the case but had formed no opinion as to the defendant's guilt. Moomin appealed his conviction all the way to the Supreme Court, claiming that he'd been denied his constitutional right to an impartial jury. But today, the High Court rejected that claim by a 5-4 vote. Writing for the court majority, Chief Justice William Rehnquist said trial judges have wide discretion to screen jurors as they please, and that the pretrial publicity in Moomin's case, while substantial, was not enough to force the individual questioning of the jurors. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, stocks closed up today 31 points at 3,000.45. Advances led declines in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. The chief Soviet prosecutor says he has ordered criminal proceedings against Black Beret troops who attacked customs checkpoints in Latvia and Lithuania. The prosecutor's action is the first by national authorities to bring the special Soviet Interior Ministry troops to justice. The troops recently destroyed 16 of the 78 checkpoints set up by the republics to emphasize their independence. The Kremlin doesn't recognize those independence claims. The troops also have stormed Latvia's police headquarters and killed 4 people. In Mexico, drug traffickers and authorities negotiated an end to the 13-day standoff at the Matamoros prison. Sandina Robbins reports.
The jailed czar of cocaine, Oliverio Chavez, apparently cut a deal with the Attorney General's office. Chavez is wounded and in serious condition from the May 17th murder attempt, which sparked a shootout inside the Matamoros prison and left 19 inmates dead. The powerful drug dealer's gang took over part of the prison, embarrassing authorities who were unable or unwilling to go in. The negotiations ended at dawn, with Chavez being flown to a hospital in Mexico City. Officials have finally regained control of the prison, located just 1 mile from the Texas border. But they refuse to say whether or not the drug lord's much-rumored arsenal of weapons has been found. Prison officials and top police officers are now under investigation for allowing the drug traffickers to continue operating from behind bars. For National Public Radio, I'm Sandina Robbins reporting.
The Commerce Department says consumer spending dropped 0.1% in April. Meanwhile, personal income moved up a slight 0.1%. Joanne Legata, a 13-year-old from Clintonville, Wisconsin, won the 64th National Spelling Bee today. She won by spelling antipyretic after a 90-minute duel with 11-year-old Maria Matthew of Sterling, Illinois. By the way, antipyretic is spelled A-N-T-I-P-Y-R-E-T-I-C. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The subject we're about to discuss makes a lot of people uncomfortable. They don't want to talk about it in public, and they even have trouble talking about it in the family. No, it's not sex. It's money. Families and money. My guest, Marcia Millman, is the author of a new book on the subject called Warm Hearts and Cold Cash. It's about the emotional issues that underlie how money is divided up in the family between husbands and wives and parents and children. Millman chairs the sociology department at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Her previous books are about the back rooms of medicine and being fat in America. Why do so many people find it so difficult to talk about money with the people they're most intimately connected to?
Family money has all these emotional overtones. It has all these symbolic meanings. That money in the family, although we define love in the family as being above financial consideration, in fact, I think money is love in the family. And people use money as a sign of how much they're loved or cared about. And the other thing is that money brings up all these subjects that people like to sweep under the rug, like the fact that there's competition in the family, or that people have competing interests, or that people are concerned about their sort of private concerns, that everyone doesn't have the same values. That money just brings up a whole slew of issues that we don't like to acknowledge about family life.
I think that family money issues are changing as the economy changes and as class definitions change. For instance, as you point out in your book, this is really the first generation of middle-class men and women with significant money to pass down to the next generation. And you say, this is a kind of startling statistic, that 1 in 10 baby boomers will inherit at least $400,000.
Yeah, no one knows exactly how much they'll inherit because it depends on what will happen to the economy in the next few years. But I think this is the first generation where there is a significant transfer of wealth from middle-class parents to their children. It used to be that the major legacy in middle-class families was a kind of cultural capital, the education and the social skills that would allow children to have a middle-class life. But because the economy has changed, this is the first generation of young adults that probably won't have the same standard of living as their parents. And it's changing their relationship to their parents because for the first time, I think that children are really dependent on the money that their old parents have. And it puts them in a more dependent relationship to their parents, and it also puts them in a more competitive relationship to their siblings. I think what's happening now is a kind of shock to many middle-class families because it's really embarrassing, but for the first time, we have all these young adults who are going back to their parents for money, and the parents really don't know what to do about it. It's kind of unprecedented. The upper class has always had rules and conventions for how to pass on money from parents to children, but the middle class has to face this for the first time.
But as you point out, the upper class has had a system for passing down money, and the middle class doesn't because it's so new to them. So what are some of the new issues that this is raising for the middle class?
Well, one of the issues is whether to support adult children, whether adult children have a right to, get help with a down payment for the house or, startup funds for a business. You know, it used to be that parents fulfilled their obligation to their children when they sent them through college or maybe graduate school. but now adult children are coming back to them for all kinds of sums. So that's one issue. The second issue is the fact that there are such inequalities among siblings in their financial fates. One of the interesting things is that we assume that people who grow up in the same family will wind up with a similar lifestyle or similar social class. But in fact, siblings wind up being almost as unequal in the amount of money that they have as people who you would pick at random in the population. So I think parents are facing the fact that their children have very different financial situations, and the parents don't know what to do about distributing money among children who have such different needs.
In other words, should they compensate and give somebody who has less more, or should they just treat everybody equally?
Yes, I think that's a big dilemma for a lot of parents.
We're just joining us. My guest is sociologist Marcia Millman, and we're discussing the subject of her new book. It's about families and money, and it's called Warm Hearts, Cold Cash. Do you find that it's very difficult for aging parents and their adult children to talk about the issues of inheritance, to talk about it because it means discussing the mortality of the parents?
Yes, I do. I think that's the hardest thing. It's almost impossible to talk about the death that everyone knows, must come. I think children have a very hard time bringing up the subject because it makes them look so greedy. Parents have a hard time because they don't want to face, the reality of the death. And also, they don't want to bring up all of the issues of rivalry and competition. I think that this is something that we have a lot of problems with, that, anyone who's spent any time around young children knows how passionate those rivalries are in the family. Almost all of my middle-aged friends attribute the problems of their adulthood to where they stacked up next to siblings when they were children, to the situation that existed 30 years before. I think that these sibling rivalries are very, very powerful, and that parents don't want to stir up these old issues by bringing up the subject of money. I think many of them would like to ask their children, you have more money than your sister. How would you feel if I left less to you and more to your sister? They're really afraid to bring up the subject because they just don't want to stir up the old feelings, and that's one of the problems.
Have you found that there are a lot of siblings who are ending up in court contesting wills?
Oh, I don't think there are many. I think that's unusual. But I do think that there are many siblings who feel resentful. I know a lot of people who resent, for example, a sibling who keeps asking a parent for money, and they would never say anything about it, but it bothers them because, of course, it's reducing the reservoir that's supposed to be available for all, and they feel embarrassed about their feelings.
No, I think this is true, that the upper class tended to always marry the upper class, so there was both people of privilege marrying into each other's families. Now, in middle-class marriages, it's often the situation that one person has or will come into an inheritance and the other person doesn't and won't. Mm-hmm. What kind of new issues do you think that's raising in middle-class marriages?
That's a really interesting issue because it brings up the whole problem of who money belongs to. On the one hand, we have this ideology that everything in the family is supposed to be shared and that nobody is counting. But privately, I think people have a sense of what money is theirs, that it belongs to them more than it does to, say, a partner. And I think certainly inherited money is often viewed as something that isn't quite, that belongs more to oneself rather than to the family as a whole. And that's a really touchy subject between spouses.
We've been talking about inheritances, but I'd like to ask you just about salaries. And it used to be in most couples that the husband was the breadwinner and the woman didn't work, so there was only one income. And now in most couples, both members are bringing in an income. So there's the question of how to divide it. Is it all pooled? Does each person maintain their own income and use that? Is it pooled 50-50, but then everybody has their own budget within that? What are some of the ways you've seen people work that out, and what reasons have they had for trying it that way?
Well, I think for people who, kind of stress merging and sharing everything, who don't place that great a value on independence, I think they're more comfortable pooling all the money. Although privately, I think they're counting. That's one of the things that goes on that people don't acknowledge. I think that people who value autonomy keep separate checkbooks. Most of the professional people I know, most of the professional women I know, prefer to keep their money separate because they don't want to have to argue with their husbands every time they want to spend money in a certain way. I think, one of the myths of the family and of marriage is that people have the same values and that they do want to spend their money the same way. And I think that it's not true. And one of the advantages of keeping your money separate is that you can do what you want with it without having to consult the other person all the time. But, that doesn't sort of match our mythology about what family life or love is all about. So some people find that offensive or difficult to handle.
Now, let me ask you, the couples who have their own separate accounts and don't pool their money, are they often embarrassed about bringing that up with other people?
Well, the ones that I know are fairly brazen about it. You know, they take, in many cases, they take a kind of feminist attitude about it. They see that in many ways, being financially dependent has been the downfall of women, and that they want to be explicit about it. They don't think that there's anything shameful about it. But they do take a lot of ribbing from friends, or often friends say to them, what kind of marriage is this where you have children together but you don't share the funds? And so it's hard. It goes against the grain in many cases. One couple that I wrote about was very careful about dividing funds. And in this case, the husband had come into some family money, and the wife, in order to keep up with him and in order to be able to have equal equity in the house, had to work over the summer when she was 9 months pregnant, and it was really hot, and she was dragging herself around exhausted. And her friend said to her, "Are you crazy? You're working, when you're 9 months pregnant to pay back your husband?" But she felt that unless she did this, he would have more power over her. And, it's one of the things that we don't like to talk about, that in the family, people exercise power, and money is one of the ways that we're able to do this. And I really respect and admire the people who are able to put this out on the table and deal with it explicitly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is sociologist Marcia Millman, and her new book is called Warm Hearts and Cold Cash: The Intimate Dynamics of Families and Money. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about families and money, and my guest is sociologist Marcia Millman. Prenuptial agreements, I think, have become increasingly popular, and I guess they're seen in a way as a technique to ward off ugly fights over money if there's a divorce. Mm-hmm. But it means settling these things before you're even married. Give us a sense of some of the prenuptial agreements you've seen. The types of arrangements people make before they're even married.
Well, I actually haven't seen any of these arrangements.
You haven't?
I've heard people talk about them. I've heard, talked to a few people who've done them. Many people have talked about them, and many of them wind up not signing the things. I think they are becoming more common, especially as families get more complicated, as people bring in children from previous marriages, as they've had second marriages. Some of the things that some people argue that it's a bad idea to have a prenuptial agreement because it ruins the romance, that it busts up the illusions that may be necessary for love. And I think it is very painful for people to negotiate these agreements because it means that they have to put their expectations out on the table. They have to see that there are limits to love, that a person you know, is not willing to share all the money that that everybody is facing up to the fact that this might not last forever. So I think it does bruise those illusions, but it's really important in many ways to do this because those illusions will go sooner or later, and I think it's better for people to have a realistic idea of what they're getting into.
Can you give us a sense of a type of prenuptial agreement that you think would work well? I know it's probably difficult to do, not having two hypothetical people with two hypothetical incomes, but still maybe you could address that in general terms.
Well, what some lawyers say is that it's good to have an agreement that's renegotiated every few years because the situation may change.
Yeah.
So that I think that would be one important part of it. I guess another thing that would be important would be for each person to have his or her own lawyer and some private time with that person to really be able to articulate all of their concerns, for it not to be something that's done at the last minute. Now, I think one of the problems of many of these agreements is that it's kind of foisted on one person by the other, usually by the person who has more money.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the questions that's often raised is, well, how fair is it if a person has to agree to this in order to get married? And it's usually the woman who has to agree. And some people feel that it's a way for men to get out of the financial obligations that, you know, would prevail if they just divorced according to the laws of the state. But I think an answer to that is that, you know, you don't have to marry someone who's making you agree to something that you don't like. It's a chance for you to really see what you're getting into, and you can accept the deal or reject it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Marcia Millman. She's a sociologist who's written a new book about families and money. The book is called Warm Hearts and Cold Cash. You point out in the book that children used to be seen as an economic asset back in the days when people farmed. You know, you needed more children to help work the farm. And from there, children went on to be seen as economically worthless but emotionally priceless. Where are we now?
Well, I think we're certainly there. This was an argument made in a lovely book by a sociologist named Viviana Zelizer. She talked about the transformation of the child from an economically useful object to a sentimental object. In a sense, I think people have children now to have a lifelong relationship. Since they can't count on this from their spouse, the relationship with the child is seen as the enduring one.
It's become very expensive to raise children, especially if you hope to send those children through college. Do you think that the cost of raising children is affecting parent-child relationships today?
Oh, yes. I think that whenever now people are thinking about having children or how many children they'll have, they have to think of it as a financial situation, as a financial calculation. They have to think about what they're giving up financially and how it will affect their lives. So I think that is very different. It's a lot more costly to bring up children now than it used to be.
Did you find in your research that parents still see children as an investment, you know, someone who will help take care of them in their old age, will help provide for them?
I don't think that they think their children will provide for them financially. I mean, if they do, they're crazy, because that doesn't seem to be happening very often. But I do think they think of their children as an emotional investment, that if they have children, they will never be alone, that there will always be someone who will love them. And I think that this is one of the great disappointments of many people, that they feel they've made this tremendous investment in their children, and the children often wind up, you know, seeming quite indifferent or uncaring, or they live 3,000 miles away, or they never call home. And I think this is one of the interesting aspects of how money gets worked into the economy of love in the family, that we think of love as being given freely, but in fact, I think it rarely is given that freely, just as money isn't given that freely. That when people feel hurt, when they feel that their children have neglected them in some way or don't appreciate them in some way, I think what they often do is they bring up all the money that they spent on their children. They bring out the old canceled checks as evidence of the investment. And as proof of how they've been injured.
No, well, money represents the sacrifices that you've made.
Yes, it does. And it is a real sacrifice.
Did you find that there were major differences between different ethnic groups and how they dealt with money in the family?
I think there are. I was writing primarily about white middle-class people. I think that every group has different rules and understandings. For example, Carol Stack has written a book, she's an anthropologist, called All Our Kin, about poor African-American families. And the idea that when you're living on the edge of survival, there's a notion that money should be shared, that just to get by, one has to be able to count on a kind of mutual aid society. I think that certainly upper-class families have a different set of rules. There's concern about not spoiling the children by giving them too much. There's also concern about not letting any generation spend all the capital and then ruin it for the next generation. I think with inherited wealth, there's a notion that the money doesn't really belong to any particular generation, that it belongs to the family for all time, and that each generation can use the interest but not the capital. And so it's considered a real crime if anyone spends the capital. So I think that every group has its own rules. And I think for the middle class, particularly the white middle class, the real rule of the family is that children are supposed to be loved equally. This is the sacred principle. And in fact, what goes on is that children are always wondering if they're loved equally. It's a kind of unrealistic notion because I think different children elicit different feelings in their parents. So everyone's kind of on the lookout for favoritism. But I think that middle-class parents are so worried about showing favoritism that they become very careful about doling out the money equally because they don't want to give any real evidence that, in fact, they preferred one child over the other. But I think this notion of loving children equally is the most sacred idea in the middle class.
Can I ask you, in all the research that you did for your new book, what was really of most value to you personally?
I think what was important to me to discover is that people suffer enormously because they feel they were cheated, that their family was not what they have a notion a family should be, and that it's really important for us to look more realistically at the limitations of love, that the fact that there is an unconditional love, that there's a lot of exchange going on in the family, that bargains are struck, and to not feel as if we're the only ones who were cheated, but that it's probably our myths of the family that are making us so unhappy about what we don't have.
Marcia Millman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marcia Millman is a sociologist and author of the new book Warm Hearts and Cold Cash. It's about families and money. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Protestant and Catholic leaders will soon meet over the future of Northern Ireland in a series of talks that are also expected to include political leaders from the Irish Republic and Britain. Pádraic O'Malley has written about the conflict in Northern Ireland in his books Uncivil Wars and Biting at the Grave, The Irish Hunger Strikes, and The Politics of Despair. Coming up, Pádraic O'Malley on myths, martyrdom, and the obstacles to resolving the conflict. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Israeli officials have reacted with hesitation to President Bush's Middle Eastern arms control proposal, but they say they do favor arms control in principle. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir conceded that President Bush's arms control initiative could have a big influence on the Middle East, but he said Israel had several questions about the initiative and he would like to discuss it soon with administration officials. Other Israeli officials were somewhat more supportive. After a meeting with visiting American Defense Secretary Dick Cheney, Defense Minister Moshe Aaron said Israel favored arms control in principle. He said Israel was continuing to study the proposal. But Israeli defense sources say Israel will only agree to the arms control plan if it includes all Arab states and perhaps even Iran and Pakistan, which, along with Israel, are believed to have a nuclear capability. Israeli officials have called for a conference of all arms suppliers to the Middle East and said they must stop supplying Arab states with weapons. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
General Colin Powell says that Allied forces may pull out of Iraq sooner than expected. Powell, now on a visit to that area, did not give a day and also cautioned that there is no hurry. Some Allied officials have indicated that the coalition could pull its 21,000 troops out starting about the middle of June. Powell also said that the Allied nations would be ready to use any means necessary to ensure that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein did not use force against Kurdish refugees. Soviet leader Gorbachev has won strong support from Italy for his attendance at a financial summit meeting in London this summer. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports from Rome.
After meeting with Soviet Foreign Minister Alexander Besmietnik, Italy's diplomatic chief Gianni De Micheli said that, as far as Italy is concerned, Soviet participation in next month's meeting is an acquired fact. He said the political conditions exist to support the Soviet Union in its economic crisis, citing the sum of $100 to $150 billion over the next 4 to 5 years. Earlier, French President François Mitterrand and German Chancellor Helmut Kohl said they favored inviting Gorbachev to the summit. Japan and Canada have said they would not oppose having the Soviet leaders sit in at the summit. Britain has not yet declared its position. President Bush has voiced reservations but has not ruled out inviting Gorbachev, who wants to present a concrete proposal for reforming the Soviet economy with foreign help. This is Silvia Poggioli in Rome.
The government says that new claims for state unemployment benefits fell by 9,000 for the week ending May 18th. This put the figure at 445,000. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials climbed close to 31 points to end at 3,045, on volume of 234 million shares. This is NPR News. NASA officials say improvements will be made in the Space Shuttle safety program to make sure that equipment problems do not come as a surprise, as they did last week. Agency officials say that they have no concerns about the fuel sensors just installed for Columbia's liftoff this Saturday. A first countdown was stopped because of fear those components might break. Columbia will carry a crew of 7. More than 24 Cleveland City police officers have been named in 4 federal indictments. These indictments and arrest capped an FBI sting operation that has been underway for over 2 years. Kevin Niedermeyer of member station WKSU in Cleveland has more.
The undercover operation was a joint effort between the FBI and the Cleveland Police Department. Today, 34 arrests were made. Of those, 30 are current or former Cleveland police officers. The charges range from illegal gambling to narcotic sales. According to the FBI, 3 to 4 officers allegedly ran the gambling ring and hired the other officers to guard against police raids. Cleveland Police Chief Ed Kovacic says as the officers were being arrested, they lost the right to wear the uniform.
In my opinion, the minute they decided to violate their oath of office, they were no longer police officers and no longer entitled to the dignity of wearing that uniform.
The arrested officers were issued plain jackets to hide their uniforms from the public and TV cameras. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
In Capitol Hill, the House has approved an $8.5 billion military construction bill that cuts what the Bush administration wanted for overseas work. The measure adds $189 million to the president's request for the National Guard and Reserve. Overall, the bill comes to $121 million more than Congress approved last year, but $80 million less than the president wanted. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In Northern Ireland, talks are about to begin about power sharing. Catholic and Protestant leaders from Northern Ireland, as well as political leaders from the Republic and England, are expected to participate. They will discuss Ireland's troubled relationship with Britain, the conflict between the Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland, and the possibility of uniting the North and the South into one republic. The talks were organized by Peter Brook, Britain's Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. My guest, Padraig O'Malley, is a journalist, scholar, and author of The Uncivil Wars, Ireland Today, and Biting at the Grave, The Irish Hunger Strikes and the Politics of Despair. O'Malley is also senior policy analyst at the John W. McCormick Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He was born in Dublin. One group that was not invited to participate in the upcoming talks is Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA. I asked O'Malley how representative these talks could be if Sinn Féin isn't represented.
Sinn Féin represents about one-third of the Catholic nationalist community. And the fear is, of course, that if agreement is reached between the parties in Northern Ireland, and that any outcome might be destroyed by the activities of the IRA. And that is a problem. But again, I think the belief is that if the parties in Northern Ireland can reach some agreement among themselves, that is, the constitutional parties can reach some agreement among themselves, that the population at large will so welcome that resolution that support for the IRA will fall away, and that people would be more anti-IRA than ever before.
What's the rationale for not including them?
There are two rationales. First is that the Sinn Féin, the political wing of the IRA, endorses the use of violence. Both the Dublin government and the Irish government are firm in their belief that the IRA must renounce the use of violence, not just call a ceasefire, but renounce the use of violence if they are to have a place at the table. And secondly, it's been difficult enough to get these talks going. And if Sinn Féin had in fact renounced violence, the Unionist parties still wouldn't be agreeable to the Sinn Féin having a place at the table.
What's the most optimistic outcome of these talks? If they really were successful, what would the outcome be?
Successful talks would involve a government within Northern Ireland in which the Catholic minority would share power with the Protestant majority, and secondly, a relationship between the North of Ireland and the Republic that recognised that there is an Irish tradition within Northern Ireland and that expressed that Irish dimension.
If these talks were successful, do you think it would be the end of the conflict within Northern Ireland?
Well, yes and no. For the talks to be successful will require an end to the violence. So I don't think that one can talk about a successful outcome if, in fact, the violence continues, because it's likely that the violence will bring down any tenuous agreement that would be reached. On the other hand, at some point in the process, I think the IRA will have to be brought in. I don't believe that you can bring peace to Ireland without talking to all of the parties involved, and that includes the IRA. It may be moralistic not to do so, but it's not pragmatic politics.
At the end of your book on civil wars, you wrote that you thought it was unlikely that there would be any resolution in the conflict in Northern Ireland for another 20 or 30 years. Are you optimistic about these talks?
No, I'm not optimistic. I believe that the differences that exist not only between the Catholic Party, the SDLP, and the Protestant parties, the official Unionist Party and the Democratic Unionist Party, are great, but that the differences between the Protestant parties themselves are great, and that there are still too many unresolved struggles within each community for there to be the possibility of consensus on the issues that are involved.
Do you think that Margaret Thatcher's departure and John Major being in is going to change the outlook for any resolution?
I mean, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mrs. Thatcher, because of her right-wing position and her stand in the Conservative Party, was able to sign an agreement with the Irish government in 1985 that a Labour government would not have been able to sign. In a sense, Mrs. Thatcher was to Northern Ireland what Richard Nixon was to China. The Northern Ireland is simply not an issue in British politics. It never surfaces as an election issue. And Northern Ireland, British prime ministers only deal with the question of Northern Ireland when they're under a great deal of pressure to do so. And they rarely are under a great deal of pressure. So I wouldn't expect any change in Mr. Major's position. The British position, which is accepted by the Irish government, is that there will be no change in the constitutional status of Northern Ireland until a majority of the people of Northern Ireland wish there to be a change in that status. So as long as a majority of the people in Northern Ireland want to remain part of the United Kingdom, it is the position of the British government that they will have that right.
And the Protestants are the majority in Northern Ireland.
The Protestants are in a majority of 60% to 40%. So before you could have a majority of the people of Northern Ireland voting for the unification of Ireland, probably at least one Protestant in three would have to change his or her mind and opt to become part of the Republic of Ireland.
And you think that's unlikely?
I think that's very, very unlikely.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Padraig O'Malley. He's the author of Biting at the Grave, The Irish Hunger Strikes and the Politics of Despair. He also wrote The Uncivil Wars, Ireland Today. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Padraig O'Malley, who writes about the politics of Ireland. Now, your latest book is on the hunger strikes. You wrote an op-ed piece after the death of hunger striker Bobby Sands, and you wrote, "There is no history now, just lies, distortion, and sham. And it is to this that the sad and awful death of Bobby Sands will add. He is myth now, part of an elaborately cultivated contrivance about the past, to conceal an ugliness about ourselves we the Irish dare not face. It is the Irish who are doing the damage to the Irish. We are our own oppressors." Why do you think the Irish are their own oppressors?
Well, because of the manner in which we have chosen to interpret our history. There are two great traditions in Ireland, the tradition of the constitutional and the tradition of the unconstitutional. The tradition of the constitutional has always put the emphasis on resolving the problem of the relationship between Britain and Ireland by resolving that problem by peaceful means, by parliamentary means. The tradition of the unconstitutional says, in effect, that you cannot resolve this problem by peaceful means. It must be resolved by violence. And for 120 years, these two traditions ran in parallel. And the vast gains made by the tradition of the constitutional in the 19th century in particular had the support of the majority of the people of Ireland. The unconstitutional tradition only popped up in uprisings, in 1798, 1816, 1848, 1867, and 1916, all of which failed, and all of which were supported by only a tiny minority of the people. Yet our history tells us that it was the tradition of the unconstitutional that actually brought freedom to Ireland in 1920. And all of our history is refracted through that prism. And youngsters in Ireland from the 1920s right through the 1980s, on both sides of the border, if they were Catholic, were taught that the people who took up a gun and went out to free Ireland were heroes. And as long as we make the tradition of violence heroic, as long as we continue to entertain the myths of heroic failure or self-sacrifice, there always will be youngsters, particularly in Northern Ireland, who will quite willingly join the IRA and die for what they think is the freedom of Ireland.
What are some of the examples that of the myths that you think a lot of politics in Northern Ireland are based on now? The myths that motivate people?
Well, the myth that motivates the Catholic community, or that section of the Catholic community which supports the IRA, is the myth that the only way to deal with the British is through the use of violence, that is what they understand. The second myth is that the partition of Ireland was brought about by Britain, engineered by Britain for its own selfish interests, and that if Britain were to withdraw from Northern Ireland, you would have miraculously a solution to the Irish question tomorrow morning. And the third myth is the myth of who we are. The Irish have defined themselves, or the Irish nationalists have defined themselves, in terms of an Irish Catholic tradition. That overlooks the fact that on the island of Ireland you have at least three separate traditions, not just the Gaelic Catholic tradition. You also have the Anglo-Protestant tradition, and you also have the Scots-Presbyterian tradition. And there is a plurality of cultures, yet the society of Irish nationalism has not found itself capable of accepting that heterogeneity of cultures.
I think our listeners at this point will really want to know what your background is in and how that figures into your perception of the politics there. Mm. It's an area where people are expected to be so partisan.
Well, I was born in Dublin, raised a Catholic in a non-political family. And while I was growing up, the issue of Northern Ireland was never an issue of any dominance in political discourse in Ireland. Irish governments simply called upon Britain periodically to withdraw from Northern Ireland, and that was that. No government ever developed a policy for trying to bring about the peaceful unification of the country. And in fact, it was not until I came to the United States that my interest in Northern Ireland began to grow, and I began to take a very serious attitude towards it after what is called Bloody Sunday in 1972. That was the occasion on which British paratroopers opened fire on civilians in a civil rights march in Derry and killed 14 people. What I find interesting in kind of looking at my own relationship to the question are two things. One thing I set out to explore in Biting at the Grave was where I stood in relationship to the violence. The question I had for myself being, if I had been born in Belfast, in West Belfast, in a deprived Catholic area of Belfast, would it be likely that I would have ended up joining the IRA? And I must confess that I think the answer is that I would have been likely to join the IRA. Young people who joined the IRA didn't start out as youngsters being believers in a United Ireland. They went through a number of very traumatic experiences in the late 60s and early 70s and found themselves in the IRA, and they then developed their political beliefs.
My guest is Padraig O'Malley. He's the author of The Uncivil Wars, Ireland Today, and Biting at the Grave, The Hunger Strikes and the Politics of Despair. More in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Israel has responded to the president's call to limit arms in the Middle East, Terry, and we will also ask about the Arrow missile that Israel wants. We have a piece from the Soviet Union on one way that people are coping with the paucity of consumer goods, barter in the USSR, and a discussion with a relief worker on the possibility that famine in the Horn of Africa might be a bit alleviated by the political changes in Ethiopia. It may be possible now to get food through and feed people.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. My guest is Padraig O'Malley, who writes about the politics of Northern Ireland. I want to get back to one of the myths that you mentioned, and that is if it weren't for England, then there could be a peaceful resolution to the problems in Northern Ireland. You once wrote, "We need England. We need it to disguise the sordid and sad reality of our murderous designs on each other. We need an enemy." Is that the function you think Britain is playing? And even if Britain gave Northern Ireland its independence, that the conflicts would continue?
That's right. As long as we continue to blame England or Britain for our problems, then we don't have to confront the truth about ourselves. And the truth is that on the island of Ireland, you have two communities, each of which claims allegiance to a different tradition. The Protestants in Northern Ireland to the United Kingdom, and the Catholics on the island of Ireland to a unified Ireland. And unless we recognize those differences as being real and stop blaming Britain for them, then there can be no resolution. Because in effect, the hardcore nationalist position would be that the Protestants of Northern Ireland are somehow brainwashed Englishmen, and that all you have to do is to have the British leave, and in a couple of months or a very short space of time, the Protestants of Northern Ireland will find, lo and behold, that they are in fact Irish. They'll kind of rediscover their Irishness. So we are intent not on accommodating difference, but on kind of submerging another culture into our own in an attempt to reproduce one homogeneous culture.
You seem to think that the politics of martyrdom really get in the way in Northern Ireland. For instance, when you were writing your book on the hunger strikers, you went to visit the parents of the hunger strikers who died. And you wrote that there seemed to be no way that you could write about the hunger strikers without hurting their families, because you wanted to dissect conventional wisdom and the families wanted to embrace it. Can I get you to elaborate on that? Because I think that gets to the essence of the kind of problem that you're talking about.
I must say that visiting these families was one of the most moving experiences of my life. But in two or three cases where there was a brother or a sister of the dead hunger striker who was married and who had children, I would talk to the children about their dead uncle. And invariably I would point to a photograph of the dead hunger striker, which always occupied the pride of place in every home, and ask a child, "Who is that?" And on every occasion, the child would answer, "That was my uncle Sean," or "That was my uncle Raymond," or "That was my uncle Patsy, who died." And I would say, "What did he die for?" And the child would say, "He was a soldier. He died to save or to free Ireland." And right there, we have the problem, because the myth is being transferred even at that point from one generation to the next. You have a generation of young people who will grow up regarding the dead hunger strikers as heroes, as martyrs, and who will seek to emulate their lives.
Why don't you think they were heroes and martyrs?
I don't think they were, well, let me qualify that. My relationship to the hunger strikes was that I was both repelled by what the hunger strikers did and attracted by what the hunger strikers did. I was repelled by the easy sentimentality that Irish people often used with regard to issues of life and death. I was repelled by the easy disposal of life, the willingness to die for Ireland rather than to live for it. I was attracted by the heroic quality, by the fact that these were young men who were prepared to lay down their lives in a very long and agonizing way in order to stand up for their beliefs. I find their beliefs to be founded on historical inaccuracy. I find their beliefs to be narrow, not to embrace the traditions or culture of the Irish people as a whole. And I find the truths, the received truths they have inherited, to be essentially false.
I want to get back to the talks that are about to begin in Northern Ireland. You've expressed your pessimism about those talks. What makes you hopeful? Do you have any reason for hope to resolution for the, of the conflict?
At the present point, I don't really. I believe Ireland is one of those conflicts that is best described in the following way, that the tendency to think in terms of solutions aggravates the problem itself, and that we should not so much look for quote-unquote solutions, but we should look to build a series of structures or processes that over time will facilitate the reconciliation of the two peoples of Ireland, the Catholic people of Ireland and the Protestant people of Ireland.
What kind of process would help reach a reconciliation?
Well, any process that makes the two communities more integrated. The most obvious thing is, of course, integrated education. At the moment, Catholics go to Catholic schools, Protestants go to Protestant schools. Each tradition learns its own version of history. Each sees the other in terms of a stereotype. So the obvious first step would be to develop an integrated system of education. And I must add that one of the major obstacles to that is the Catholic Church, which, of course, insists on having its own schools and is not at all interested in integrated education.
Pádraic O'Malley, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Pádraic O'Malley is a senior policy analyst at the John W. McCormick Institute at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. His latest book is Biting at the Grave, The Irish Hunger Strikes and the Politics of Despair. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Last week, the Supreme Court upheld a lower court decision denying federally funded family planning clinics the right to give information about abortions. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the South Bronx doctor whose clinic was represented in the Supreme Court case, Dr. Irving Rust. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.